recognize it as a warning. I feel a hand on my arm and open my eyes. Nice night, isn't it? Al says mildly. Careful back here, it's slippery. I'm all right. He tightens his grip on my arm. Come sit with me. In a minute. Did anyone ever tell you you're as stubborn as a mule? I laugh a little. Once or twice. We gaze out into the dusk. On the shore, faint lights glow in the windows of a faraway house. Our house. I'll stay here with you then, he says. You don't need to do that, Al. Wouldn't want anything to happen. Couldn't forgive myself if it did. The weight of sorrow presses on my chest. I grip the shell, feeling its blunt knobs. Then I let it slip from my fingers. It makes a small splash. What was that? Nothing important. The shell sinks quickly. I'll never have to look at it again, or hold it in my hand. What Promises I Make. 1946.
Hello, Christina.
A woman's artificially high voice comes through the screen. In here, I say. Who is it? The woman pulls open the door and steps into the kitchen like she's stepping onto a sinking ship. She's of indeterminate middle age, wearing a worsted wool suit and stockings and pumps and carrying a casserole.
I'm Violet Evans, from the Cushing Baptist Church. We have a hospitality club, and well, we've put you on our list for a stop-in visit once a week.
My back stiffens. I don't know about any list. She smiles with aggrieved patience.
Well, there is one.
What for?
Shut-ins, mostly.
I'm not a shut-in.
Mm-hmm, she says, glancing around.
She holds up the dish.
Well, I brought you chipped beef and noodles.
She squints into the gloom. It's late afternoon, and I haven't lit a lamp yet. Until she came inside, I hadn't really noticed how dark it is in here.
Maybe we could switch on a light?
No electricity. I'll find a lamp if you'll wait a moment.
Oh, don't go to any bother for me. I won't stay long.
She steps gingerly across the floor and sets the casserole on top of the range.
I spilled a little on my skirt, I'm afraid. Can you point me toward your sink?
Reluctantly, I direct her to the pantry. I know what's coming.
Why, this is a pump,
she says with a little surprised laugh, just as I knew she would.
My heavens, you don't have indoor plumbing?
Obviously, we don't. We've always managed fine without it.
Well,
she says again. She stands in the middle of the floor like a deer poised to bolt.
I hope you and your brother like chipped beef.
I'm sure he'll eat it. I know she expects me to act more appreciative. But I didn't ask for this casserole, and I don't particularly care for chipped beef. I don't like her haughty manner. As if she's afraid she'll catch a disease by sitting in a chair. And something in my nature bridles at the expectation that I must be grateful for charity I didn't ask for. Perhaps because it tends to be accompanied by a kind of condescending judgment, a sense that the giver believes I've brought my condition, a condition I'm not complaining about, mind you, on myself. Even Betsy, who understands me, is always wanting to improve my lot. She washes the dishes with her delicate hands and puts the crockery back in the wrong places. I find the broom behind the door and the dish rag drying on the back stoop. One day she showed up with a pile of blankets and sheets and plunked them on the table in the dining room.
"Let me take those old rags you sleep on," she said. "I think it's time you had some fresh linens, don't you?"
Everyone knows I'm proud. Betsy's the only one I'll tolerate speaking to me like this. She gathered up my bed covers, which, it's true, had seen better days, especially the threadbare blue blanket Papa knitted, and hauled them outside, tossing them in the back of the station wagon to take to the dump.
"Don't worry about the Pyrex,"
the woman from the Baptist church assures me.
"I'll collect it next week."
You don't need to keep doing this, really. We get along just fine. She leans over and pats my hand.
We are glad to help, Christina. It's part of our mission.
I know this woman from the Baptist Church means well, and I also know she'll sleep well tonight, believing she's done her Christian duty. But eating her chipped beef and noodles will leave a bitter taste in my mouth. Most summer days, around mid-morning, when heat thickens over the fields like a gelatin, Andy is at the door. There's a new intensity to his demeanor. His son Nicky is almost 3 years old, and Betsy is pregnant again, due in a month. Andy needs, he says, to produce some work that will support his growing family. Sketch pad. Paint-smeared fingers. Eggs in his pocket. He kicks his boots off and roams around the house and fields in his bare feet. Makes his way to the second floor and moves from one bedroom to another. Trudges up another flight to a long closed room. I can hear him opening windows on the third floor that haven't been cracked in years, grunting at the effort. I think of his presence up there as a paperweight holding down this wispy old house, pinning it to the field so it doesn't blow away. Andy doesn't usually bring anything or offer to help. He doesn't register alarm at the way we live. He doesn't see us as a project that needs fixing. He doesn't perch on a chair or linger in a doorway with the air of someone who wants to leave, who's already halfway out the door. He just settles in and observes. All the things that most people fret about, Andy likes. The scratches made by the dog on the blue shed door. The cracks in the white teapot. The frayed lace curtains and the cobwebbed glass in the windows. He understands why I'm content to spend my days sitting in the chair in the kitchen, feet up on the blue painted stool, looking out at the sea, getting up to stir the soup now and then or water the plants, and letting this old house settle into the earth. There's more grandeur in the bleached bones of a storm-rubbed house, he declares, than in drab tidiness. Andy sketches Al doing his chores, picking vegetables and raking blueberries, tending the horse and the cow, feeding the pig. Me sitting in the kitchen beside the red geraniums. Through his eyes I am newly aware of all the parts of this place, seen and unseen. Late afternoon shadows in the kitchen. Fields return to flower. The flat nails that secure the weather clapboards. The drip of water from the rusty cistern. Cold blue light through a cracked window. The lace curtains Mame crocheted, now torn and tattered, blow in an eternal wind. She is here, I am sure of it, watching her life and stories transform, as stories will, into something else on Andy's canvas. One cloudy day, Andy blows through the door with a grim expression and stomps up the stairs without stopping to chat as he usually does. I hear him banging around up there, slamming doors, swearing to himself. After an hour or so of this, he plods back down to the kitchen and sinks into a chair. Mashing his palms over his eyes, he says, "Betsy is going to be the ruin of me." Andy can be dramatic, but I've never heard him complain about Betsy. I don't know what to say. She's decided she wants to restore an old cottage on Bradford Point for us to live in, without even consulting me, I might add. Damn it all to hell! This doesn't strike me as entirely unreasonable. Betsy told me they're living in a horse barn on her parents' property. Do you like the cottage? It's all right. Can you afford to fix it up? He shrugs. Yes. Does she want you to help? Not really. Then, he gives his shaggy head a violent shake. I don't want to be shackled to a house. The way we're living is perfectly adequate. You live in a barn, Andy. In two horse stalls, Betsy said. They're fixed up. It's not like we're sleeping on hay bales. With one child and another on the way. Nicky likes it, he says. Well, I think I can understand why Betsy might not want to live in a barn. Picking at a patch of dried paint on his arm, Andy mutters, This is what happened to my father. Houses and boats and cars and a dock that needed constant repairs. You get in too deep, start hemorrhaging money, and then you're making decisions based on what will sell, what the market wants, and you're ruined. Goddamn ruined. This is how it starts. Fixing up a cottage isn't quite the same as all that. Andy narrows his eyes and gives me a curious smile. Except for my unhappiness with his portrait, I've never really disagreed with him. I can tell it startles him. I've known Betsy since she was a girl, I say. She doesn't care about material things. Sure she does. Not as much as some women, maybe. But I would never have married those women. You bet she cares. She wants a nice house and a new car. He sighs heavily. She's not like that. You don't know Christina. I've known her a lot longer than you have. Well, that's true, he concedes. Did she tell you how we met? Sure, she was bored one summer and started coming to visit. Not just to visit. She knocked on the door one day, she was only 9 or 10, and came in and looked around and set to work washing dishes. Then she started showing up every day or so to help out around the house. She didn't want anything for it. She was just being herself. She used to braid my hair. I think about Betsy pulling the clips from my long hair and working through it with a wide comb, patiently teasing out tangles. My eyes closed, head tilted back, the sky orange inside my lids, the strands of hair caught in her brush threaded with silver, her small hands strong and firm as she separated my hair into 3 strands and wove them together. Andy sighs. Look, I'm not saying she isn't a lovely person, of course she is, but girls grow into women, and women want certain things. And I don't want to think about any of that. I just want to paint. You do paint, I say with rising impatience. All the time. It's the pressure I'm talking about. It's hard not to be influenced. But you aren't. You wouldn't be. It's all about the work. You always say that. She always says that. He sits there for a minute, drumming his fingers on his knee. I can tell there's more he wants to say that he isn't sure how to articulate. My father loved all that stuff, you know. The trappings of fame. Just makes me angry. What makes you angry? That he valued that stuff, you mean? Yeah. No, I don't know. He stands abruptly and goes to the window. I was almost hit by the same train that killed him, did you know that? At the same intersection, several years ago. I was driving along, thinking about something else, and I looked up and jammed the brakes at the last second and the train went firing past. So I know what it was like for him to see that train bearing down. The horror of it. The futility of realizing there's nothing you can do. He hesitates, then adds, And I'm filled with rage at losing him. Losing him too soon. Ah, all right, I think. I'm angry at losing him, but I'm also angry at the waste, he says. The time wasted, the energy squandered on meaningless possessions, the compromises. I don't want to make the same mistakes. I think of the mistakes my own father made toward the end of his life. I know how the death of a parent can be both a release and a reckoning. You won't. I'm about to. Let me make you a cup of tea, I say. He shakes his head. No. I'm going back up. Rage is good for the work. I'll pour it in. And sorrow and love, all mixed together. Standing in the doorway, gripping the frame, he says, Poor Betsy, it's not her fault. She wanted a normal life, and she got me instead. I think she knew what she was in for. Well, if she didn't, she does now, he says. 1917 to 1922. For the first time in years, the summer days hold more hours than I know what to do with.
I order wallpaper from a catalog in the Fales store and enlist Mother's help in transforming the rooms downstairs. If this is to be my home, let it at least be papered with small pink flowers on a field of white. Mother persuades me to join groups I've previously disdained. The Friendly Club, the Helpful Women's Club, the South Cushing Baptist Church Sewing Circle, with their ice cream socials and apron sales and weekly meetings. I borrow books from the library that Walton didn't recommend. Ethan Frome, in particular, with its bleak New England winters, its agonizing compromises and tragic mistakes, keeps me up at night. I take sewing orders for dresses and nightgowns and slips from ladies in town. I even agree to go to the Grange Hall on a Friday night with Ramona and Eloise and my brothers. Though when I hear the cheerful piano and fiddle music wafting through the trees as we get closer, Tiger Rag and Lady of the Lake, I want to vanish into the woods. As soon as we arrive, everyone disperses.
"You poor dear,"
Gertrude Gibbons yelps from across the room when she spots me. She rushes over and grabs my hand.
"We were all so sorry to hear."
"I'm fine, Gertrude," I say, attempting to fend her off.
"Oh, I know you have to say that,"
she stage whispers.
"You are so brave, Christina."
"I'm not." She squeezes my hand.
You are, after all you've been through. I would crawl into a hole."
"No, you wouldn't."
"I would. I would just collapse. You are so..."
She sticks her lip out in a pretend pout.
"You always make the best of things. I admire that so much."
And just like that, I've had enough. I close my eyes, take a breath, open them. "Well, see now, I admire you." She puts a hand on her chest.
"Really?"
"Yes. I think it would be hard to have such a slender sister when you try so desperately to watch your weight. That doesn't seem fair at all." She stands erect, pulls her stomach in, bites her lip.
"I hardly think..."
"It must be very difficult." Reaching out, I pat her shoulder. "Everybody says so." I know I'm being unkind, but I can't help myself. And I don't regret it when I see the hurt look on her face. My heart is shattered, and all that's left are jagged shards. Mother has begun spending entire days in her bedroom with the shades drawn. Dr. Heald comes and goes, trying to figure out what is wrong. I hover in the shadows out of his way. It appears that she has a progressive kidney disease and possibly a heart condition. He tells us finally, she needs to rest. When she feels up to it, she can venture out into the sunshine. She has good days and bad. On bad days, she doesn't come out of her room. When she calls for tea, I make my way up the stairs slowly, rattling the teacup in its saucer, splashing the hot liquid on my hand. On good days, she appears after I've finished washing the breakfast dishes and sits with me in the kitchen. Now and then, when she's feeling particularly well, we'll take a picnic to Little Island, timing our walks to the ebb of the tide. We are quite a pair. A sickly woman short of breath and a lame girl lurching alongside. Mother keeps Mamay's black Bible, worn and faded from years of travel, on the table beside her bed, and often thumbs through its gossamer pages. Now and then she murmurs the words aloud she knows by heart. We rejoice in our sufferings, knowing that suffering produces endurance, and endurance produces character, and character produces hope. For this light, momentary affliction is preparing us for an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison. One morning I come to the barn to bring Papa a jug of water, and find him slumped against the mule in its stall, a strange grimace on his face. Startled, I drop the cup and stumble forward.
"Help me, Christina,"
he gasps, reaching out a hand.
"I can't get up."
His muscles constrict and spasm. His legs are so painful, he says,
that he can barely move them. When I finally get him into the house, he lies on the floor of the kitchen and kneads his calves, trying to dull the pain. Al goes to fetch Dr. Heald. After examining Papa, he announces that it must be arthritis, and there's not much he can do. With Mother in and out of bed, and Papa increasingly infirm, the duties of the household fall even more heavily on my brothers and me. We have no choice, or the whole farm will slide into entropy. Animals unfed, the cows needing milking, tasks doubled for the next day. To get it all done, I have to dim my brain, turn it down by notches like the flat turn knob on a gas lantern, leaving only a nub of flame. As summer turns to fall, envelopes with 2-cent stamps postmarked Boston begin to arrive for me at the post office again. Ramona's small family wedding, she reports, has grown, predictably, into a more lavish affair. Her dress will be modern, despite her mother's objections. A white satin V-neck with a skirt just below the knee, a wide satin belt, and a bridal cap veil. Not, God forbid, her grandmother's, with its crumbling yellowed lace. If suffragettes can picket the White House, I can express my emancipation from long skirts and old veils, Ramona declares. She will carry a bouquet of irises, like the bride on the cover of Hearst's magazine. The invitation, on thick cream cardstock, hand-painted with pastel flowers, arrives in an oversized cream envelope. I stand in the road and read the words etched in florid black script. Mr. and Mrs. Herbert Carl, respectfully request the honor of your presence at the marriage ceremony of their daughter Ramona Jane and Harland Woodbury. Equally respectfully, on notebook paper, I decline to attend. My brothers are busy with the harvest, and I must prepare for the holidays, but we all send our best wishes to the happy couple. And later a silver plate tea service, marked down on sale at a home goods shop in Thomaston. After the wedding, held in early November, I receive a honeymoon postcard, postmarked Newport.
Such magnificent houses! All the ladies here wear furs.
And, a few weeks later, a note describing the sunny apartment in a new brick building that the newlyweds are renting in Boston.
You must come and visit in early spring. I know Al will be busy with the planting, so bring dear Sam, Ramona writes. He needs an adventure, and so do you. It's neither haying nor holiday season, so no excuses. A few weeks only. Nothing will be disrupted.
The idea of traveling to Boston under such vastly different circumstances than the one I envisioned sends me to bed with a headache for the afternoon.
You know we can't possibly go, I tell Sam when he confronts me with the letter, which I foolishly left open on the dining room table.
Why not?
The distance. My infirmity.
Nonsense, Sam says.
I've never been anywhere, nor have you. We're going.
Looking at tall, handsome Sam, with his strong jaw and aquiline nose and piercing gray eyes, I think of all those seafaring Samuels he was named after, setting off to explore the world. Sam is 20 years old. Ramona is right. He needs an adventure. You go, I urge him.
Not without you.
But Al can't manage the farm on his own.
He's not on his own. Fred is here, and Papa will help.
I give him a skeptical look. Papa hasn't been much help for a while now.
Al will be fine. I'm not taking no for an answer.
So it is that early on a March morning in 1918, despite my trepidation, Al drives us through the fog to Thomaston, where Sam and I will catch a train bound for North Union Station in Boston. The staircases and ticket lines, narrow hallways and train platforms, are a bewildering obstacle course for both of us, made even more difficult by my tight new shoes. Sam carries both suitcases and an overcoat and still manages to keep a firm arm under mine, steadying me as we slowly make our way toward the gate. When we finally get to our railway car, we collapse onto the red leather seats. A few minutes after we've left the station, Sam asks,
"Got anything to eat?"
I had packed a few dry biscuits in my bag, but when I pull them out, they crumble in my hand. Just as I'm thinking we might have to wait until Boston, the conductor, a red-faced man with a bristly mustache, happens along to collect our tickets. Sam fumbles through his jacket for them.
"Let me guess," the conductor says. "First time on a train?"
I nod.
"Thought so."
He leans over the seat.
"Lavatories are in the next car."
He points a meaty finger toward the right.
"And the dining room is four cars down. You can get a hot meal or a cup of tea, or whiskey if you prefer," he says, chuckling.
His breath is briny, like lobster. "Thank you," I say. But after he moves along, I tell Sam, "I don't think we should. We need to budget. We've brought $80 for the entire visit. The round-trip fare has already eaten up $5.58 each." But I'm also reluctant to make a spectacle of myself, jerking back and forth.
"What we need to do is eat," Sam says.
"You go and bring me something small." Sam knows what I'm thinking. Four long cars. He stands with a flourish and holds out his arm. I take a deep breath and rise to my feet. But now there's another question. Do we take our things with us so they won't be stolen? Or do we leave them here? An elderly woman with a face like a cellar apple leans forward in her seat across the aisle.
"Don't worry, dears. I'll watch your bags."
The swaying of the train actually disguises my infirmity. Accustomed to having to work to keep my balance, I adjust to it more quickly than Sam, who weaves from side to side like a drunkard. In the dining car, we eat ham sandwiches and drink tea with milk and sugar, gazing out at the rushing dark. For years I've dreamed of this moment, or rather, a moment like this. How different it is from my imaginings. My ankles are cold, my feet pinched in these new shoes, the air sour with tobacco smoke and body odor, the bread stale, the tea weak and bitter. And yet, here I am, going somewhere new. How shockingly easy it was to pick up and go, to buy a ticket and board a train and head off into the unknown. Portland, Portsmouth, Newburyport. We slow into stations one after another that never have meant more to me than words on a map. When we arrive in Salem, I think about our ancestor who lived here. I imagine Bridget Bishop standing on the scaffold, trying desperately to use the sentence against her to her own advantage. "If you truly believe I'm a witch," she must have thought, "then you must also believe I have the power to harm you." I've always assumed that John Hawthorne trumped up those charges against rebels and misfits as a way of enforcing social codes. But now I wonder, what if he really did believe those women were capable of ensnaring his soul? When we pull into South Station, it's dark and cold, and we must take three different trains to get to the Carls, one of them elevated, which requires dragging our bags up and down stairs. With Sam's arm under mine, I concentrate on my steps, one foot up, the next one down. When I dreamed of a life with Walton, I hadn't thought about what it would be like to navigate city living. Everything comes back to this body, this faulty carapace. How I wish I could crack it open and leave it behind. Despite my trepidation about being in Boston, it's exciting to be in a new place, and easy enough to pretend that everything is all right, to chat amiably with Ramona as she fries eggs for breakfast, exclaim over her wedding gifts and the charming view of the cobblestone street from the apartment window, play card games in the evenings at a square folding table in the living room with her and Harlan and Sam. Though I can't help flinching when Harlan suggests we play Old Maid. But just under the surface, my heart feels raw. painful to the touch. Beneath my smiles and nods and exclamations, I drift through each day like a ghost, silently keening for what might have been. Here, in Harvard Yard, Walton and I might have rested on a park bench. At Jordan Marsh Department Store, we would have selected furniture and dishes. On the banks of the Charles, we'd spread a quilt for a picnic, and I'd lean back against his chest, watching the rowers go by. At night, I fall into bed exhausted, overwhelmed by a grief so overwhelming that I can hardly breathe. In spite of my best efforts, Ramona isn't fooled. One morning, she says, apropos of nothing, "It was brave of you to come." The two of us are sitting at the breakfast nook, eating soft-boiled eggs in china cups and toast propped in a silver rack. Sam and Harland have gone for a stroll. "I'm happy to be here." She takes a sip of coffee. "I'm glad." "It couldn't have been an easy decision to make the trip."
"No," I admit.
"But Sam insisted."
"I know, he told me. But
you are having a nice time, aren't you?"
I nod, buttering my toast.
"Of course, a lovely time. I want to tell you, Christina."
She sets down her spoon.
"You must be wondering. Walton lives in Malden. He rarely comes into the city these days." I look in her eyes. "I was wondering.
I hope that sets your mind at ease.
Does he know I'm here?"
"I told him.
I felt I had to, in case..."
"It makes sense.
You're friends."
I can hear the bitter edge in my voice. She bites her lip.
"Family friends, from childhood. It's hard to just cut people off, even though..."
Shaking her head, she says,
"I don't know how to explain it. I feel like a traitor. I know how painful it was for you. He behaved abominably."
Ramona seems so sincerely distressed that I feel a trickle of empathy for her.
"You don't have to explain. I understand."
"Do you?"
she says hopefully.
"The past is past."
I know it's what she wants to hear. She smiles, clearly relieved.
"I'm so glad you feel that way. I do too.
And by the way, I know you said you aren't interested, but Boston is filled with eligible bachelors."
"Ramona," she flaps her hand.
"Yes, yes, I know. You've hung up your rod. You can't blame a girl for trying."
A few days later, Ramona says, "I can't imagine it's easy for you, Christina dear, all this perambulating around." She's right. Every inch of Boston has been treacherous for me, from the cobblestone streets to the crowded sidewalks. She and Sam and even bumbling Harland steer me into the elevator and down the steps, offering steady arms for our afternoon strolls. Even so, I trip and stumble.
"I truly appreciate your help," I tell her.
"Oh, well, it's nothing. But it does seem, perhaps, that your situation is more acute than it used to be. I see you wincing sometimes. Are you in pain?"
I shrug. "The pain has become part of me. Just something I live with, like my pale eyelashes and skimmed milk skin. But when I wake in the morning now, it takes several minutes of stretching and kneading before I can move my hands. And my feet often feel mired in glue. I can't walk more than 4 or 5 steps on my own without losing my balance."
"Christina, Walton told me he had a conversation with you about this some time ago. He said he urged you to come to Boston to see if something could be done."
I feel my face flush.
"He didn't have any business."
She raises a finger.
"This is not about Walton. I spoke with a doctor, a very good doctor at Boston City Hospital, and he thinks they might be able to help. It wouldn't be right away, not this visit. We'd need to make an appointment. All I'm asking is for you to consider it. Look," she sighs, "don't you want to have a normal life with normal opportunities? You refused before, and..."
Her unsaid words linger on the air. I know what she's implying, that my unwillingness to consider treatment may have cost me the relationship. I feel a surge of anger. Yes, this was exactly what I feared at the time. That Walton's feelings for me were conditional. That he was telling me to get better or else. But the anger subsides as quickly as it arose. It would be nice to have a normal life. I'm tired of pretending to be strong. Of hiding the fact that even the smallest chores exhaust me. I'm tired of the bruises and scrapes and the pitying looks of people on the street. Maybe this doctor could actually help me. Who knows? Maybe he can even make me well. All right, I tell Ramona. I'll consider it. She smiles.
Good. We just might get that leaky boat of yours patched up after all.
Newspapers are filled with dispatches from the front. The Boston Globe reports that the United States is sending nearly 10,000 soldiers to France every day. In Cushing, we heard occasional stories about boys who enlisted, or, after the Selective Service Act was passed last year, were drafted. My farmer brothers, like many in our area, were exempt. We listened to radio reports. But here, the news is not an abstract event, happening far away. Walking across Harvard Yard, Sam and I come upon several thousand young men in blue regulation sailor suits, new recruits attending radio school. Boston Common is lined with Red Cross tents, where volunteers collect and pack supplies to ship overseas. When the suffragettes who've been picketing in front of the White House for more than 2 years are disparaged in opinion columns, Ramona and Eloise are incensed and talk about it at length. They know the names of some of the ladies, the arguments for why women should be given the vote. They talk about these events as if they have a stake in the outcome, as if they have a right, an obligation even, to an opinion. But this has nothing to do with us, I say.
It has everything to do with us, Ramona replies indignantly.
None of the tasks that fill my days in Cushing are relevant in Ramona's world. It's as if she's playing house in her four-room apartment overlooking the street, four flights up, with no one to take care of but her well-meaning but slightly ham-fisted husband, and plenty of money with which to do it. How different my life would be with electric lights and an indoor toilet, hot water that comes out of a faucet in the kitchen and the lavatory, gas burners on the stovetop that ignite with the flick of a match, cast iron radiators that heat every room. If I weren't spending all my time stoking the fire, maybe I, too, would know what's going on in the wider world. Ramona attends the opera, the latest plays. She browses in the millinery store and the ladies' shops. She has a girl, Ramona calls her that, though she's older than us, who comes in twice a week to take the laundry, scrub the floors, change the bedding, dust the brake front, and wash the dishes while Ramona sits at the table in her dressing gown reading the Boston Herald. Ramona refuses to step outside without a hat and a dress in the latest style. Freshly starched and ironed. I, who have two plain dresses, two skirts, two blouses, and two slightly crumpled hats to choose from, spend a lot of time waiting for her to get ready.
Oh, Christina, you must be exasperated, she says with a sigh,
hurrying out of her bedroom, pinning on one of her many hats in front of the hall mirror while I idle by the door.
All this falderal, primping and pin curls and hat pins. I expend so much energy worrying about how I look. You just are who you are. I envy that.
I don't believe her. She is living the life she wants to lead. But I don't really envy her either. Even without an infirmity, it would be hard to adjust to these narrow streets clotted with buildings and pedestrians, and endure incessantly clanging streetcars, blaring horns, squealing brakes, music drifting from doorways, human chatter.
The Boston sky, watered down by lamplight, is never completely dark. I miss the thick, star-sprayed blackness of Hawthorne Point at night, the soft glow of gaslight, the moments of absolute quiet, the view of our yellow fields and the cove and the sea in the distance, the horizon line beyond. Ramona, and even Harland, bless him, are more than generous, but when it's time to leave, I am ready to go. The day of our departure is brilliantly sunny. Snow is melting into puddles in the streets. Yellow and purple crocuses in the park have burst overnight through the slush. I'm in my tiny bedroom, tucking my few belongings into my suitcase, when there's a rap at the door. It's Sam. May I come in? Sure. When he opens the door, I look up. His eyes are sparkling, and he has a huge grin on his face.
So are you nearly ready?
Yes. Are you?
Not quite.
Well, hurry up, then. I hold up a long skirt and fold it in half. We don't want to miss the train. He wavers in the doorway, half in the room and half out, his hand on the knob.
I'm not ready to go back.
I look up in surprise.
What?
He presses his forehead against the door and sighs.
I've been thinking. If I'm going to spend my life in a tiny place in the middle of godforsaken nowhere, I want at least to see something of the world.
Isn't that what we've been doing?
I think I'm just getting started, he says.
I'm having trouble wrapping my mind around this. So, you want to stay on with Ramona and Harland? Have you asked them if they mind?
Actually, Herbert Carl has offered me a position as a mail clerk in his company and a room in their house, so I wouldn't need to stay here.
It dawns on me slowly that he's been hatching this idea for a while. Why haven't you told me about this?
I'm telling you now.
But what will... How will...
You'll be fine, he says, as if reading my mind. I'm going to escort you to the station, and then I'll turn right around and go to work.
Well, what about the farm?
Al and Fred can manage. Anyway, it'll be good for Fred to step up and help out more. He's been the baby of the family for too long.
I feel stung. You've thought this through.
I have.
Without even consulting me. He squirms in the doorway like a dog being scolded.
I was afraid you wouldn't approve.
It's not that I don't approve. It's that I... What is it exactly? I suppose it's that I feel...
Abandoned, he says.
It's as if we both realize it at the same time. My eyes fill with tears.
Oh, Christina, he says,
coming over and putting a hand on my arm.
I've only been thinking of myself. I wasn't thinking of you at all.
Of course you weren't, I say, choking on the words. I know I'm being melodramatic, but I can't help myself.
Why should you? Why should anyone?
Turning away from him, I reach for a folded handkerchief in my suitcase and weep into it, my shoulders shaking. Sam steps back. He's never seen me like this.
I'm being selfish, he says. I'll come home with you on the train.
After a few moments, I take a deep breath and dab my eyes with the handkerchief. Outside the window, I hear the clatter of a streetcar, a honking car. I think of Mamet's wanderlust, her desire to see the wider world, her frustration that no one in the family seemed to share her ambitions. Why shouldn't Sam stay in Boston? He has his entire life ahead of him. No, I say.
No?
You shouldn't come home.
But you...
It's all right, I tell him. I want you to stay.
Are you sure?
I nod. Mamet would be proud.
Well, I'm hardly sailing around the world, he says with a smile. But perhaps Boston is a start.
Sam, as promised, escorts me to the station and puts me on a train. He looks so young and handsome and happy standing on the platform, waving goodbye as the train pulls away. As Boston recedes into the distance, The domestic concerns that have receded from my thoughts swim back into focus. How is Mother's health? Has she been sleeping well? Did she manage the cooking? I think about the dirt I'll find in the corners of the kitchen, the piles of laundry that no doubt await, the ashes piled up in the range, the mule, the cows, the chickens, the pump behind the house. I look out at the horizon, horizontal bands of color, black to blue, to russet to orange, a line of gold, and then blue again. Heading north is like going back in time. When the train pulls into Thomaston, it's cold and muddy and gray. Exactly how Boston looked when I arrived there several weeks ago. A few months after I've returned, Mother sits me down at the dining room table, a letter in her hand. Papa stands behind her in the doorway. Sam and Ramona would like for you to go back to Boston to be evaluated. The Carls know a very good doctor who...
Yes, she mentioned it,
I interrupt. Now that I'm home again, back to my familiar routines, Boston seems very far away. The disruption of my chores, the effort of the journey, not to mention the almost certain painfulness of the procedure, and the far from certain outcome, it's hard to imagine why I would put myself through such an ordeal. I said I'd consider it, but honestly, I don't think there's any point. Mother reaches for my wrist and grasps it before I can pull away. She turns it over, revealing raised red strips on my arm.
Look. Just look at what you've done to yourself.
I've started using my elbows, my wrists, my knees to lift heavy pots, balance the tea kettle, and fill it with water from the pump, lug it to the range. My forearms are striped with burns. Partly for this reason, and partly because over the years my arms have become thinner and more stick-like, I hide them as often as I can in voluminous sleeves. I yank my arm away, slide the sleeve down to cover it. There's nothing anyone can do about it.
We don't know that.
I get along fine, Mother.
If it continues getting worse, you will not be able to walk. Have you thought about that?
I busy myself brushing some crumbs on the table into a pile. Of course I've thought about it. I think about it every day when I navigate the 14-foot-long pantry by using my elbows along the walls.
Do you think you'll get along fine when your legs don't work at all? She persists. It's decided,
Papa says abruptly. We both turn to look at him.
She's going to Boston, and that's the end of it.
Mother nods, clearly surprised. Papa really asserts his opinion with such force.
You heard your father, she says.
It seems there's no use arguing. And who knows? Maybe they're right. Maybe something can be done to reverse or at least slow my decline. I pack two equally weighted bags to help me keep my balance, and Al borrows a neighbor's car to drive me to Portland, so I won't have to change trains by myself. When I reach Boston, Sam and Ramona pick me up in Harlan's brand new sky blue Cadillac sedan and drive me to City Hospital on Harrison Avenue in the South End, a stately brick building with giant columns and a turreted dome, where I'm admitted for a week's observation. A hen-breasted nurse pushes me in a wheelchair into an elevator, accompanied by Sam and Ramona, and up to a small private room on the 8th floor, with an iron bed and a view of the neighboring rooftops. It smells of paint thinner.
When are visiting hours?
Ramona asks. The nurse consults my chart. No visitors.
No visitors? Why on earth not?
Sam asks. The prescription is rest. Rest in solitude.
That hardly seems necessary, Ramona says.
Doctor's orders, the nurse says. I'll leave you alone with her for 10 minutes. Then you need to let her settle in. You can come back to collect her in a week. Looking over at me, she lifts her beak. There's a hospital gown on the bed for you to wear. The doctors will do their rounds later in the afternoon.
Any questions? I shake my head. No questions. Except, what is that smell?
Ether, Ramona says. Horrid. I remember it from when I had my tonsils out.
And overcooked peas, Sam adds.
When the nurse leaves, Ramona pulls a book out of the bag she's carrying and places it on the nightstand. My Antonia.
I haven't read it, but apparently it's all the rage. Country life in Nebraska.
She shrugs.
Not my cup of tea, but if you get bored.
Looking at the book jacket, gold with bronze lettering, I realize that this must be the third in Cather's Prairie trilogy. I read the other two at Walton's suggestion. A line from O Pioneers pops into my mind. People have to snatch at happiness when they can in this world. It is always easier to lose than to find.
We'll ask the nurse exactly when you're being discharged so I can be here to pick you up, Sam says.
I'll be counting the minutes, I say. If you finish that book, I can bring more, Ramona says. Sherwood Anderson has a collection of stories everybody's talking about.
Once a day, a gaggle of doctors, goose-like in their white coats, march into the room and gather around my bed. Led by a specialist, I come to think of as Big Bug because of his eyes, enormous behind oversized spectacles. The doctors instruct me to stand up, wave my arms, and stomp my legs, and then, muttering among themselves, troop back out again. They act as if I don't have ears, but I hear everything they say. The first few days they speculate that perhaps electricity will help. By day 4, they decide that electricity would be disastrous. Nobody seems to have the slightest idea what's wrong with me. On the 7th day, Big Bug releases me into the care of Sam and Ramona with a sanctimonious smile and a prescription.
You should go on living as you've always done, he declares,
steepling his fingers at me while the other doctors scribble notes on their pads.
Eat nourishing food. Live out of doors as much as you can. A quiet country life will do you more good than any medicine or treatment.
I don't suppose she needed to travel all the way to Boston to learn that, Ramona mutters under her breath.
On the train home, I squint out the window at a silver dollar moon, framed in a blue velvet sky. I've done what my parents wanted me to do. They don't have to fret about a cure we didn't seek. This disease, whatever it is, will advance as it will. I think about the destructiveness of desire, of wanting something unrealistic, of believing in the possibility of rescue. This stint in Boston only confirms my belief that there is no cure for what ails me. No matter how long I hold a stick with fluttering rags above my head, no trawler in the distance will be coming to my rescue. Though I am only 25, I know in my bones that my one chance for a different life has come and gone. I pull the now dog-eared copy of My Antonia out of my satchel. I've read it twice, and leaf through the pages, looking for a line that comes near the end. Ah, here it is. Some memories are realities, and are better than anything that can ever happen to one again. Maybe so, I think. Maybe my memories of sweeter times are vivid enough and present enough to overcome the disappointments that followed, and to sustain me through the rest. If Alvaro had been born in a previous generation, he would have been a ship captain like our ancestors. His stoic temperament is ideal for sailing. His passion for the sea, up before dawn in all kinds of weather, out on the ocean as light seeps into the sky, is in his blood. But when Papa's hands stiffen and gnarl, when Sam shows no sign of returning from Boston, and Fred gets a job at a dry goods store in Cushing and moves to an apartment in town, Al is the only one left to run the farm.
This farm is in fine shape,
I overhear Papa telling him one spring morning.
I've managed to save more than $2,000. The horse team and the equipment are paid off. Now it's up to you to keep it going.
Later that morning, Al clips our mare, Tessie, to the runner, guides her down to the shore, and loads up his dory, the boat he goes out in every day. He brings it up to the house, hauls it into the shed attached to the kitchen, and stores it upside down, high in the haymow, with all his fishing gear. Then he dry docks his sailboat, the Oriole, on the tip of the point of Little Island. "What are you doing?" I ask him. "Why put the boats away?"
"That time is past, Christy."
"But maybe someday."
"I'd rather not be reminded," he says.
Over the next few months, thieves pillage the dry-docked sailboat, stealing the fixtures and lanterns and even pieces of wood, leaving its decimated carcass to rot in the grass. The fish house behind the barn falls into disrepair, the tools inside languishing like relics from a long-ago era. Decoys, bait barrels, boat caulking, lobster traps as dry and bare-boned as fossils. In the late afternoon, when his chores are done, I sometimes find Al in the shed, fast asleep beneath the dory on a pile of horse blankets. I feel badly for him, but I understand. It's painful to hold out hope for the things that once brought you joy. You have to find ways to make yourself forget. One day a delivery man from Rockland shows up with a wheelchair, and from then on, Papa is rarely out of it. "What do you need that thing for?" I ask him.
"We should get you one, too," he says.
"No, thank you." Papa's bones ache, he says, when he tries to do just about anything. His arms and legs have thinned and weakened. They're contorted in a way that's familiar to me. But he calls his condition arthritis and refuses to believe it has anything to do with mine. Both of us are proud, but we wear our pride differently. Mine takes the form of defiance, his of shame. To me, using a wheelchair would mean that I've given up, resigned myself to a small existence inside the house. I see it as a cage. Papa sees it as a throne, a way to maintain his fleeting dignity. He finds my behavior, my limping and falling, undignified, shameless, pathetic. He is right. I am shameless. I am willing to risk injury and humiliation to move about as I choose. For better or worse, I think. I am probably more Hawthorne than Olausen, carrying in my blood both intractability and a refusal to care what anybody thinks. I wonder, not for the first time, if shame and pride are merely two sides of the same coin. In a fit of optimism, or perhaps denial, Papa buys a car, a black Ford runabout, for $472 from Knox County Motor Sales in Rockland. The car, a Model T, is shiny and powerful, and though Papa is proud of it, he is too infirm to drive it. I am too. So Al becomes the family chauffeur, taking Papa and the rest of us where we need to go. He drives to the post office every day, whatever the weather, and picks up the mail for our neighbors along the road, distributing it on his way back. He does errands for Mother in Thomaston and Rockland. The car provides Al a measure of freedom. He starts going out at night now and then, usually to Fales, where a group of men can be counted on for a card game. Old Irving Fales making a dime or two barbering in the middle of it. During one such evening, Al hears about a treatment in Rockland that supposedly cures arthritis, administered by a Dr. S. J. Pohl. The next day he drives Papa into Rockland to find out more. The two of them come back talking animatedly about apples and surgery-free treatments, and at supper we pore over the contract Papa has been given to sign. The gist of it is that he will be required to eat many apples. There's a small orchard behind our house that he planted 15 years ago. The trees are laden with shiny red and green apples, but these apparently are not the right kind. He has to eat a specific variety, one he can only get in Thomaston for 5 cents apiece. I flip through the pages of the contract. It is fully understood by me
that while S.J. Pohl believes that he can help and perhaps cure me, he in no way guarantees anything, it reads. It is mutually agreed that no money paid by me for his services shall be refunded. I am of lawful age.
57. That's lawful age, isn't it?
Papa laughs.